Wednesday, June 24th, was as busy as Tuesday was light. It began with the arrival ceremonies at 10 for Prime Minister Papandreou of Greece and his party. Thank goodness the rain stopped just in time, and the south grounds were beautiful and green, if misty. Prime Minister Papandreou's wife is dead, but his daughter-in-law, an American citizen who married the younger Papandreou when he was a professor of economics at the University of California, was in the party. I had met her, and also Mrs. Kostopoulos, the wife of the foreign minister, when I was in Greece for the funeral of King Paul, and they had taken me on sightseeing tours. I was intrigued by the strange drama of this American citizen, caught up so intimately in the politics of Greece, at a time when the Cyprus situation may mean serious damage to NATO, even the dissolution, or even war. When the echo of the last cannon shot had died away, the arrival speeches had been delivered, and the last hand of the diplomatic corps shaken, the men departed for Lyndon's office to talk serious business, and I took Mrs. Papandreou, Mrs. Kostopoulos, and Mrs. Matsos, the wife of the ambassador, and Virginia Rusk upstairs for coffee and sweet rolls, and they weren't a bit good. They were not zephyrs. It was interesting to speculate how the fate of both of these countries, Turkey and Greece, hung to some extent upon a very elderly leader, Inonu of Turkey and Papandreou of Greece. The talk was about the Queen, whom they say is once more lively, beautiful, and active, and very vigorously planning the wedding of young King Constantine in September. I wish I had some better levers, some tools to open up the conversation on little formal encounters such as this. Perhaps on our last year in office, I'll just start off by saying, now what do you think about the Cyprus situation? The next event of the day was to go to the National Geographic Building, an organization I regard as only slightly less respectable than the Bible, to inaugurate picture phone service for the American Telephone and Telegraph Company and Bell Telephone Laboratories. This service now exists between Washington and New York and Chicago. It costs $16 to talk for 3 minutes from Washington to New York and see the face of the person you're talking to. In my case, I talked to Dr. Elizabeth Wood, a woman scientist in the Bell Laboratories who had helped develop this great new scientific advance. I congratulated her on her work and the work of all the people in the laboratories who had produced it, talked about what it would mean to parents whose children were off in college. Last year, one of the happiest events of the week was our call to Linda, and all the family tried to get in on it. And if we could have seen her face at the same time, it would have been wonderful. And I told her I thought grandmothers would probably be her next best customers. Then we discussed how soon picture phone service would be available throughout the United States. It'll pop the general impression it would be within the next decade. Back at the White House, I had a hot dog in the room with Linda. While Lyndon was downstairs at a stag luncheon for Prime Minister Menzies of Australia, who is sandwiched in between Turkey and Greece. I was glad to see on the guest list that we had such old friends as Marvin Watson and Edgar Lincoln Hoger there. But I think the chef went a little all out on giving the menu international names this time. He had cold cream of Senegalese and rice a la Greek. In the middle of the afternoon, I left by commercial jet for Detroit. At the airport, I was met by Mrs. Lenore Romney, the wife of the governor, Mayor and Mrs. Kavanaugh, and Mrs. Lowe, president of the American Association of Home Economists. And with these three ladies, I drove into town to the Statler Hilton, where I had time for a hairdo and a change to evening clothes. Before I spoke to the 55th annual meeting of the Home Economists, some 3,000 in all, in the Ford Auditorium. Because it was a group that I felt pretty well affiliated with, they teach home economics in high schools and colleges. They're county home demonstration agents attached to land-grant colleges throughout the country. Or they do public service work, demonstration of equipment and so forth, for utilities, like Jack Brooks' mother, Grace, does. The speech rather wrote itself. It was an easy speech and an easy group. The theme was get involved. American women hold a tremendous potential of strength for good. I do not refer to the sense of power that comes from flicking a switch or turning an ignition key, but to the force we exert when we mark a ballot, teach our children, or work for a better community. How can we best mobilize this potential? And the answer was, broaden our experiences, and become involved. At one point, I undertook to answer what probably a number of people are thinking. When I go on trips, like to Kentucky or to Wilkes-Barre, what am I doing here? And I do sometimes wonder it. The answer is, perhaps when I visit, it helps draw the curtain open a little more. Perhaps it gives national attention to local problems. Perhaps it exposes us to ourselves. This is the other face of America. Look and act. To me, the interesting thing about getting involved in writing a speech like this and going to see a group of women like this is to find out what they really do. And that's what I enjoyed about it. I found that home economists in some 16 or 17 states have been put on the staff right along with social caseworkers in the state and city departments of welfare to work on the problems of needy people. I found that there are some 8 million homemakers who are permanently or temporarily disabled, blind, one-armed, in a wheelchair, polio, something that causes them to need technical professional help. And that in many states, these home economists are equipped to help them handle their problems. And then I suggested to them that perhaps they might better re-examine the college curriculum for home economics. Perhaps more emphasis should be placed on the low-income families and less on the middle-income and upper-income in order to deal more effectively with the people that would come to them. The president, Mrs. Lowe, who is from Texas A&M, and I'm sure that's why they asked me, gave me a Betty lamp on a little charm and a small replica of the lamp, which is alleged to be a very economical way to light a house, as a little present to take back to London. Very seldom do I get a laugh out of an audience, so I was pleased when one of the beginning lines about London being perfectly willing and quite agreeable for me to come out and make this speech, when he said, having found out that there would be so many home economists gathered there, "Go and bring back any tips you can get on stretching food and budgets. We can use them at the White House." When the speech was over, Mrs. Lowe escorted me to the room where they were having the reception, where it had been planned that I would stand in line and greet the first few guests that came by. But it's very hard to break away from a group, especially with Mrs. Romney, the wife of the governor, on my right, who has made such a splendid record for campaigning all over Michigan. How could I holler quits before she did? Besides, there's always the feeling that you might disappoint somebody who came from Rosebud or Dimebox and had been rather looking forward to meeting you. So I stood there for an hour and a half and met, I think, the entire body of the 3,000 delegates. It turned out that two of them, delightfully enough, had been schoolmates of Lyndon at Southwest Texas State Teachers College, and two of them rejoiced at my mention of the NYA in the speech and said, "We are products of the NYA." Finally, about 10:30, I went back up to my suite, having said goodbye to the last one, sampled the delicious chili con queso that the chef had so thoughtfully made for us, had a drink, and went to bed with that good feeling that I've earned tonight's rest.